From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The National Archives recently announced it had found an original handwritten military order dated June 19, 1865, that read, quote, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free." It went on to state that, quote, "This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor." The order's date marking freedom for enslaved people went on to be remembered as Juneteenth. And while slavery has been dead for more than a century, many argue the hallmarks of the deadly institution are still alive through prison labor and our system of mass incarceration. My guest is Erin Hatton, an associate professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Her research is centered on the sociology of work, while also extending into the fields of race and gender, social inequality, culture, labor, law, and social policy. She joins me to discuss her new book, Coerced: Work Under Threat of Punishment. Welcome to the program, Erin.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So is there a straight line between slavery, between the practice of slave labor in the United States and our current economic system, particularly when we examine prison labor?
There is absolutely a straight line. It's not without its bumps, but there is indeed a very, very straight line, particularly in the South, between the abolition of slavery and the rise of the disproportionate incarceration of Black people, particularly Black men, but not exclusively Black men, and the extraction of their labor while they are incarcerated. Now, many people know, but not everyone, know that the sole exception to the abolition of slavery is prison labor. If this is written in the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, prisoners can be forced to work in the U.S. according to the Constitution.
And this became the topic of a very important documentary by filmmaker Ava DuVernay.
That's right. And so what I do in the book is I draw connections between prison labor to other forms of labor, which are also, I argue, coerced, although not to the same degree as prisoners. But look, prisoners can be forced to work. They can be compelled to work. And in this era of mass incarceration, when so many people are living and sometimes dying behind bars, we also tend to lose sight of the fact that they are also compelled to work. These are workers as well. Most often, they do the labor to keep the institutions running, and their bosses wield such expansive punitive power over them.
So I imagine that the rules around what governs prison labor varies state by state, because most prison systems are run by individual states. We have our federal prison system, and then we have the state prison system, and then we have, of course, the county jails. But what sort of rules govern how prisoners can be compelled to work, what they're paid, what kind of work they're made to do? I mean, I remember a lot of people last year during California's horrific fires expressed shock that it was prison labor that was used to put out some of the fires, and they might not have even realized that this is such an extensively used form of labor. So what are the rules that govern what prisoners can be compelled to do?
Well, there are, as you suggest, there are some variances across states in terms of what wages they're paid, if any. In fact, and quite a number of states do not pay prisoners anything for their coerced and forced labor. In New York State, where I did my research, prisoners typically earn between 10 and 33 cents an hour. Prisoners who worked in the fire camps of California would often earn about a dollar an hour, depending on. So the wages and the rules vary a little bit depending on the state, but also depending on whether the prisons are state prisons versus private prisons, and also even within prisons, the different types of labor arrangements they have, the fire camps versus doing janitorial work inside the prison.
Does the justification for prison labor lie within this very American idea of individualism, hard work, and also this punitive sense that those people who are incarcerated deserve to be there. And if they're there, then they should be working to offset the costs of them being imprisoned.
In many ways, it does. We do have this American ideal. It's not exclusively American, but one we certainly wholeheartedly embrace, this ideal of individualism and independence. Now, this notion of what is considered independent and what is not considered independent is very much a social construction, right? We kind of bend our definitions of what's deemed dependent or independent depending on the situation to suit our needs. So when people work for wages, even if they are dependent on their employer to survive in a capitalist economy, they are deemed to be independent wage earners. But prisoners who labor behind bars are seen as dependents. They're constructed as dependents on the state. And so no matter how much they work, they are seen as being required to work to kind of pay back for their crimes. It's kind of a pile-on. They're paying back for their crimes. They're said to be rehabilitated through labor, although rarely are they offered the skills to fully be rehabilitated in that way. And then also, they're said to be paying back for the cost of their incarceration. So they are constructed as dependents who are required to labor, must be forced to labor to pay back for that.
And within that context, then the extent of our mass incarceration takes on a different characteristic as well. The more people we imprison, the more we can extract labor from them. There is this horrendous incentive to incarcerate as many people as possible.
That's right. It's a really perverse incentive to incarcerate. But it doesn't only stop there, because in point of fact, not only are kind of record numbers of people in recent years, at least not, it's declined slightly in the past couple of years, but in general, in this era, record numbers of people are living behind bars. And also record numbers of people are not behind bars, but are entangled in the criminal justice system. People who are on probation, or people are on parole, or people who have to pay back criminal justice debts. And these people also can be forced to work on the outside, outside of prison. But so they have to find a job and keep a job under threat of incarceration. And if they lose their job for any reason, if they quit because their employer is abusive, they can be sent to jail. And so all of these workers who are entangled in the criminal justice system, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, they are all compelled, coerced, sometimes forced to work in often unjust circumstances.
So you have a situation where the prison guards mete out punishment, discipline workers. But when you put workers in the situation of a labor environment, their bosses become the guards and the ones that mete out punishment too.
That's right. And that's really the dynamic that I focus on in the book. It's the kind of expansive power that these bosses wield over the workers, because it's not just an officer and prisoner relationship. It's also a labor relationship in which prisoners are performing labor and the officers are their bosses overseeing that labor. But they're not typical bosses, right? There are no HR departments breathing down their necks. There are no places, kind of neutral parties to which prisoners can go if there's a problem in the workplace. As one prisoner told me, yeah, sure, there's a grievance system, but we're just grieving to the same people who grieved us, right? There's no one we can go to. And so these officers are their bosses. And if you do anything wrong, if you don't comply with any order, it is commonly the case, the routine punishment is for prisoners to be put in solitary confinement. That is, confined to a segregated and enclosed cell for 23 hours a day without human interaction, cutting people off from society, cutting social beings off, people who need social interaction with their family and friends from society, which many bioethicists call the very definition of torture.
The box they get put into.
That's
right. The box. So you have this situation where workers, broadly speaking, enjoy some modest measure of labor rights in society at large. I imagine that most of those do not apply to prison labor.
That's right. Virtually none of them.
So the right to organize a union, you know, any of these, the right to have a safe working environment?
That is right. I mean, technically speaking, there are protections against prisoners being purposefully injured in the workplace. There are technically protections against discrimination for race and other protected reasons. But by and large, prisoners are completely unprotected by the kind of loose band of labor and employment protections that we have put in place for most other workers.
While the United States has this culture of individualism and hard work, as we talked about earlier, there's also a strong sense of individual freedoms. How do the proponents of prison labor square their, you know, desire to see the prison labor being employed and the fact that there is nothing remotely linked to freedom in their in this institution?
That's right. So we do have a very strong embrace of freedom and individuality, but it's deeply imbued with notions of morality and immorality. And so in the case of prisoners, they are categorically deemed as an immoral population. We kind of don't care what they did. We don't care how they got there. We don't care about perhaps the injustice system that put them there, or the fact that they were unjustly accused and should not be there in the first place.
Or even if they are, they're still human beings. In the end, they're still human beings.
Absolutely. Violent criminals, non-violent criminals, you name it, they are still human beings. They are living behind bars, which is the punishment that we have deemed acceptable. But what we tend to do is pile on. So it's not just now living behind bars that's enough, but also mandating their labor, i.e. slavery. So we see taking away those freedoms, freedom from being enslaved, as entirely justifiable, kind of as a culture. This is what people believe, that this is different. They are exceptional. They are criminals. They are immoral. And so we can take essentially everything from them, including their right to be free from slavery.
Your book is called Coerced, Work Under Threat of Punishment. That applies to labor that's outside the prison walls as well. Let's talk about how this approach to coerced labor extends to the poor in this country. We have a debate between Republicans and Democrats, and sometimes between Democrats and Democrats, going on for years around welfare and the notion of welfare and how those Americans who rely on government assistance should, of course, have to earn it, even though, of course, the whole point of taxpayer-funded welfare is to help people when they're in need. So how do these notions of work and the coercion of work get extended to welfare recipients and people in under the poverty line?
That's right. So it's actually a really interesting comparison between welfare recipients and prisoners. Of course, welfare recipients are not overtly seen as criminals in the American kind of public imagination, but implicitly they are. Mm-hmm. In fact, most welfare recipients are presumed to be criminally defrauding the system, right? So there's an assumption of their criminality. And because of this, this culturally constructed presumption, because in fact studies show that for the most part, they are not defrauding the system, right? But so there's a presumption of their immorality. There's a presumption of their laziness, that they don't really want to work, and so they must be forced to work. And we see these same kind of tropes, the same rhetoric deployed against these different populations of marginalized, disproportionately Black groups of people in the U.S. So prisoners are criminals, they must be forced to work to make them better people. Welfare recipients, now too, especially with the implementation of welfare reform in 1996, they are implicitly criminals, they're defrauding the system, they're lazy. They too must be forced to work. So in order to receive their public assistance, more and more people were assigned to quote unquote work activities, often nonprofit organizations or maybe cleaning subway cars in New York City or public parks, kind of menial activities, not for skill development, not to find a good job, but just to keep them busy, really just to punish them for accessing benefits to which everyone should have available.
There's also the issue of drug testing welfare recipients, which is part of that seemingly, that moral lens through which people are viewed.
That's right. I mean, through so many different measures in so many different ways, the welfare system in the U.S. is incredibly punitive. It is so judgmental. It starts with the presumption that anyone who comes to their office seeking help is immoral, is lazy, needs to be disciplined, and really needs to be punished. And they do so through a variety of mechanisms, drug testing, surveillance, cutting them off whenever possible, often unfairly through bureaucratic paperwork, putting them to work in pretty crappy jobs without any chance of getting out of them, right? If you are required to work all day for workfare in order to receive your benefits, and that's the only time that you have childcare help, that's the only time for which you have maybe transportation assistance, when are you going to find a job? There's so much rhetoric about independence and getting welfare recipients into the workforce, but when you look at the system, it is entirely not designed to help them get good jobs. It is designed to first keep them out of the system, and if they're in, to discipline and punish them.
You also extend your analysis to athletes and student athletes, which I found very fascinating. How does this apply to this kind of labor, to athletic labor?
That's right. So the focus of my book is really around these rather unusual labor relations, right? All of these groups are not legally considered employees protected by employment laws like minimum wage and overtime and workers' comp, right? And I analyze the power dynamics that are involved in these labor relations and really the kind of outsized, expansive, punitive power that bosses can wield in all of these different labor relations, from prison labor to workfare to student athletes, and then all the way to graduate students. But what I want to make sure that I emphasize here is that I don't say that these are the same, right? Student athletes are not prisoners. They are not coerced and compelled to become athletes. They can choose to leave that labor relation. But once they are in that labor relation, once they are working, putting their bodies on the line day in and day out, working hard, their bosses, their coaches, have expansive power over them and their lives and their futures.
Now, we also, of course, are finding ourselves today in the midst of this pandemic in a situation where America's traditional labor workforce, in particularly low-wage work, is finding itself coerced. And of course, you would have written your book before the coronavirus pandemic, but how do you extend your analysis to so-called essential workers who have been told in state after state that you have to return to work because the pandemic is over, which of course it's not. And if you don't, you will lose your unemployment benefits. I mean, isn't this also a form of coercion?
It absolutely is. It's a slightly different form of coercion than the type I identify and talk about in my book. I call that status coercion. So it's a little bit different, though it does intersect with economic coercion, the basic coercion that all workers experience to some degree and to different levels. But we've seen now in the current in this current crisis, this public health crisis and this economic crisis, that so many workers are experiencing very high levels of economic coercion. When they are told that they must go back to work, potentially putting their lives at risk or their family lives at risk, or lose their jobs, this is an incredibly intense form of coercion that they need to be protected against. No workers should put their lives at risk on the job.
What about undocumented workers and immigrant workers, immigrant labor in particular? Even though this country vilifies immigrants and immigrant labor, it relies heavily, especially on farm workers, on, you know, people in the food industry, in the service industry, and the undocumented status of an immigrant worker can stand in the way of them receiving their full menu of rights.
That's absolutely right. So, in theory and on the books, undocumented workers should have access to all of the rights and protections that other workers receive. In practice, that's absolutely not the case. And they absolutely experience the type of status coercion that I analyze in the book, because effectively their bosses have power over whether they are deemed to be legitimate workers earning wages and working in the United States, or criminals to be deported and oftentimes separated from their families. This is incredibly vast, punitive, horrific power that these employers wield. And what it does is it dampens worker activism. It means that workers won't push back when their wages are unfairly cut or maybe robbed. They might not push back if they are laboring in dangerous or unsafe working conditions. So it really is an kind of compounds economic coercion with this power that employers have to effectively have workers deported.
And I imagine that notion of morality comes into play here as well. Well, they're undocumented, so they broke the law, therefore they do not deserve that same treatment that others deserve.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's really important and fascinating to take a critical eye to when we use these notions of morality and immorality, deservingness and undeservingness. And we'll see again and again over the course of American history and across sectors in the US today, that when we start talking about people who don't deserve it, we're using that as a tool to justify taking away their rights, taking away their voice, taking away their claims to protections and status and full citizenship of the US.
And the undercurrent, the implicit undercurrent running through your entire analysis, and of course explicitly you write in the book, but at least through our conversation, is that this is an issue of racial justice, right?
It absolutely is. I mean, so three of the four groups of workers I analyze in my book are disproportionately workers of color, mostly African Americans, but certainly not exclusively. And so one of the things that I talk about, so it's a qualitative study, right? I interviewed workers, ultimately about 120 workers for this study. So it's not a massive survey of these workers. I can't draw conclusive data about which categories of workers are mistreated more often than others. That's not what I can do. But what I can do is examine how these, what I argue are fundamentally racialized institutions, prisons, welfare, student athletics, particularly basketball and football, in the context of racialized white universities, how each of these groups face actually pretty remarkably punitive power from their bosses, even athletes. We don't think about it in common discourse, but they too are told to kind of shut up or get out, almost explicitly from their coaches behind the scenes. So they face these punitive measures, I argue, in part because these labor relations, these organizations are racialized as Black. And so the punishments that are wielded are considered to be acceptable in our society because of the racialization of these labor relations.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Erin, and sharing your insight and analysis. People can, of course, get a lot more detail by picking up a copy of the book and reading it themselves. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Erin Hatton. She is an associate professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Her research is centered on the sociology of work, while also extending into the fields of race and gender, social inequality, culture, labor, law, and social policy. And we've been discussing her new book, Coerced, Work Under Threat of Punishment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.